Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news from the week beginning the 12th of August. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story looks at how leaders should broach future of work issues with staff. According to Robert M. Falzon, Vice Chairman of US personal finance firm Prudential Financial, in an interview with Quartz at Work, a combination of honesty, directness and business forecasts based on an outlook of no more than 4 years should drive the difficult conversations that bosses must have with staff about the future of work. In terms of how that forecasting will impact upon employees, he notes, it's a matter of sitting down with individuals, group by group, function by function, business by business, and explaining frankly how the forecasts will affect those people or groups. He says, you need to be thinking about this kind of skill development, because in the next 3 years, if you're not, you could find yourself actually without a job, because what you're doing today, we're going to need a lot less of it. That's the kind of conversation, honest conversation, to be having with individuals. Kate, to what extent do you think other leaders should follow this approach?
Being honest and direct in this situation would obviously be far preferable to being dishonest and indirect, if you like. What he's advising, which I think is really powerful, is that the responsibility to ensure that you're employed in the future is a shared one. He, as an employer, is saying, look, there are disruptors around the corner for this industry. And of course, there are always ones that we can't predict. But take the automobile industry, for example, with the advent of self-driving cars. We know that that's going to have a huge impact on all aspects of the motor industry. And the best thing individuals can do is keep themselves employable. So that means keeping your CV up to date, ensuring that you're aware of what's going on in your industry, that you're learning all the time. Because if you're marketable, you're insuring yourself to some extent against the vagaries of the particular industry or sector that you're working in. And of course, the great thing about that, if people are keeping themselves up to date, are marketable, they're much better employees in the organisation that they're in because they're there through choice, not through necessity or nobody else wanting them.
Thank you very much, Kate. Now, just before I go and check my CV, we will have a look at our next news item, which asks, is the real living wage a talent issue? This concerns five Waterstones booksellers who publicly criticised the firm's pay policy have now left the company. It emerged on the 10th of August. As regular News and Views readers may recall, our blog of the 1st of April reported on a petition signed by hundreds of authors and thousands of members of the public urging Waterstones to pay their customer-facing staff a minimum of £9 per hour nationwide and £10.55 in London, in line with the real living wage. However, a news item at The Guardian has revealed that bookseller April Newton, who started the petition, and four colleagues from branches around the UK who helped deliver it to bosses have all decided to quit. This stands in stark contrast to the approach of Scottish clothing manufacturers Mulca, which announced at the end of July that it had become a living wage employer. Co-founder Ross Marshall said, paying the real living wage has business benefits as it helps us to recruit and retain the best staff, reduce absenteeism and encourage higher productivity, all of which contribute to our progressive business model. Kate, does this show that the real living wage is now becoming a critical tool in the leader's quest for high quality talent?
You're certainly not going to attract and retain high quality talent if you're not rewarding people adequately. And as we said at the time with Waterstones, if the argument is they're unable to pay a fair wage, then there's something about the business model that's flawed, or there's something about the decision makings about how income is distributed that's flawed. And these five employees have said, we're not going to stand for it. It's a very powerful message if you are looking for talent to say, we're a good employer, we pay fairly. And looking at the ratio of the lowest paid to the highest paid gives you a powerful insight into how valued the people who work in that organisation are. And I think it would be difficult for Waterstones to argue they really value their people if they're not rewarding them adequately. So with increased attention on the ethics, not only of supply chains, but how well you treat staff, how flexible your policies really are, how family friendly, how seriously you take well-being. This is another indicator of Malka have shown that way of evidencing that you actually walk the talk.
Thank you very much, Kate. Our next story asks if female leaders may find a boardroom more like a beauty pageant. Writing in the Sunday Times magazine, Clarissa Farr, the headmistress of St Paul's Girls' School for more than a decade until she retired in 2017, suggests that, unfortunately, beauty is part of successful leadership for women in a way it shouldn't be. Farr adds, we need to see more normal-looking female leaders such as Angela Merkel, who are judged by their words and actions. Naomi Wolf, author of both The Beauty Myth and Outrages, Sex, Censorship and the Criminalisation of Love, told the Sunday Times that female bosses' attractiveness should not even be discussed. By talking about the appearance of women CEOs, we put discriminatory attention on their appearance, she said. I think whether there is pressure to look attractive depends on the sector. Finance, property and advertising are very objectifying professions still. Women in these fields probably feel more pressure to conform to certain ideals. Kate, how do you react to Clarissa Farr's claim that good looks can give female bosses the authority they might otherwise be deemed to lack?
I don't think Clarissa is really actually saying that. And if we look at research that's been done, certainly a former colleague of mine, Barry Harper, in 2000, identified a very high link between attractiveness and income. So whether you're a man or a woman, there are benefits to being attractive, which is undoubtedly the case. To say that a woman as a leader would be taken more seriously because she looks a certain way, I think I'm with Naomi Wolf here saying, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about why we recruit, what the talents that we need for the job, how good people are at relationships. Because by talking about what people look like, we are then giving it an importance that it probably doesn't warrant. We should be talking so much more about the results that they deliver, what they actually achieve, what they take responsibility for, and how well they inspire the people around them.
Thank you very much, Kate. Now, our final story asks whether you should aim for good enough rather than perfection. In her blog in the Compass newsletter, Jessica Green writes that the key here is to decide when perfect is needed and when good is good enough. The minimum viable product, MVP, is the release of a product that consists of the smallest number of features possible to provide value to users. In a perfect world, new products and features would have all the bells and whistles upon initial release. But if you add all these bells and whistles only for the product or feature to flop, then that product has been a waste of time and effort. Releasing an MVP, something good enough but not perfect, allows you to get feedback earlier and start profiting from the product sooner. Kate, can leaders ever truly be comfortable with being associated with a product or service that is less than perfect?
It's a fine line here, isn't it, Rod, between, oh, that'll do, that's good enough, which is quite an ambitious position to take, or a recognition that we're still learning. I'm often surprised how many people, even advocates of experiential learning, forget that you learn from experience. How can you possibly predict how a product or service is going to be received if it is new to market? You haven't sold that one before. You don't know. So get it out there, test it. But it has to be in that spirit of we're learning, we're going to make this better, we're going to listen to what people say to us and we're going to make improvements. Not, oh, this'll do, let's get that out there. There's no point spending any money on making it better because that's not treating your customer with sufficient respect.
Thank you, Kate. Any issues that are going on in the Institute that you'd like to talk about, Kate?
Well, we're very excited at the moment planning for International Leadership Week, which takes place in November of this year, 18th to the 21st. Already, we've got loads of speakers who've signed up who want to be part of it. It's totally online, digital experience all around the world. Marshall Goldsmith has already signed up, Dori Clark. So please do keep an eye on the trending email to see how you can register for the plethora of events that we have scheduled.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's always good to leave on a very positive note. This concludes this week's episode, and listeners can find further topical content in the news and views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.